Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast, Bridgegate and Defrauding an Organization Receiving Federal Benefits Edition. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On January 14, 2020, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Kelly v. United States, a case asking whether a public official defrauds the government of its property by advancing a public policy reason for an official decision that is not that official's subjective real reason for making the decision. In 2013, in a New Jersey scandal known as Bridgegate, petitioners William E. Barone Jr. and Bridget Ann Kelly manufactured a gridlock traffic jam in Fort Lee, New Jersey, after the mayor refused to endorse then-Governor Chris Christie's re-election campaign. Under the guise of a traffic study, the two limited Fort Lee motorists' access to the George Washington Bridge, the busiest bridge in the world, over the period of 4 days, coinciding with the local school district's first week of school. Barone and Kelly were indicted in 2015 for conspiracy to obtain by fraud, knowingly convert or intentionally misapply property of an organization receiving federal benefits, conspiracy to commit wire fraud, actual wire fraud, and conspiracy against civil rights. A jury convicted both defendants on all counts. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit reversed and vacated the civil rights convictions, but affirmed all other judgments of conviction. The Supreme Court subsequently granted cert, however, to consider whether a public official can defraud the government of its property by advancing a public policy reason for an official decision that was not actually the public official's subjective reason for making the decision. And now, to discuss the case, we have Aaron Sheely, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Oklahoma College of Law.
On January 14th, the Supreme Court heard argument in Kelly v. United States. In essence, this case raises the timely question of how much of politics as we have come to know it actually violates federal criminal law. It's important to understand first that while there are many forms of fraud known to the federal code, the oldest and most central are the mail and wire fraud statutes. The mail fraud statute actually dates all the way back to the 19th century, when Congress sought to prevent criminals from co-opting the Federal Postal Service to serve illicit ends. Since then, however, federal prosecutors have creatively expanded the sorts of conduct they will pursue under the statute and its companion statute, the newer but near identical wire fraud statute, in the sort of federal prosecutorial innovation in this area has given rise to the famous expression, when in doubt, charge mail fraud. Because the courts tend to apply the jurisprudence around the mail and wire fraud statute to other forms of federal fraud, the two relevant federal statutes here, wire fraud and the fraudulently obtaining property of an organization receiving federal benefits offense, both raise essentially identical interpretive issues. Namely, does a public official who lies about a legitimate policy reason for an action taken with purely political motives commit fraud under any of these statutes? The actual language of the wire fraud statute punishes anyone who uses electronic communication for the purposes of executing, quote, any scheme or artifice to defraud, or for obtaining money or property by means of false or fraudulent pretenses, representations, or promises. Now, the electronic communication component, that's basically any time you send an email or use the phone, that's enough to be considered to be using the wires for the purposes of falling into the wire fraud offense. So, interestingly, that hook of the wires and then the hook of the mail in the mail fraud statute, those are usually the easiest elements for the government to prove. In terms of what the elements of the fraud itself consist of, courts have long construed the language of the statute to require the government to show two really important things. The first is deceit on the part of the defendant, and the second is a deprivation of something of value to the victim. Now, these come from old common law principles of fraud, They don't appear in exactly that language in the statute itself, but the jurisprudence flowing out of the mail and wire fraud statutes relies heavily on the fact that common law fraud had existed prior to the creation of these statutes by the U.S. Congress. So it's a very, very heavily common law inflected area of federal criminal law. In addition to those two requirements of deceit and deprivation, the deceit must be material. In other words, it must have the tendency to influence or be capable of influencing the decision maker to who it is addressed. So in this case, what we have from an evidentiary perspective is that it appears that Baroni would not have had sufficient discretionary authority to shut down the traffic lanes. And so he and Kelly needed to come up with a justification to get the various career Port Authority officials to take the required steps to go out onto the GW Bridge and close lanes. And so Baroni and Kelly essentially ended up telling everyone else that they were conducting a traffic study. So at first blush, it seems that the government has proven the element of deceit here, but the two sides seem to agree as an evidentiary matter about the nature of the deceit involved. And this is something that both sides spend quite a bit of time on in their briefs, almost talking past one another to some extent. The defendants state that they lied only about their motivation. In other words, they requested a traffic study, but they didn't care about the actual results of the traffic study. They requested the study basically to mess with the city of Port Lee, New Jersey, and they concealed that improper motivation, but it was a legitimate traffic study. They just didn't pay attention to it after they had it. The government, on the other hand, says that they lied actually about the existence of the traffic study in the first place, an argument it supports by noting that the jury was instructed at trial that guilt required a finding that Kelly and Baroni did not actually believe that the reductions were part of an actual traffic study, which we must actually assume to be true on the basis of the guilty jury verdict. So this distinction ends up becoming most relevant for policy reasons rather than for truly nitty-gritty statutory interpretation reasons. The petitioner's brief emphasizes that if the convictions aren't overturned, she would essentially be criminalized for concealing the political motivation behind an otherwise legitimate official act. In that case, as she states, all that would separate a routine decision by a public official from a federal felony would be a jury finding that her public policy justification was not really and truly her authentic subjective reason for making that decision. And obviously, we can see the enormous swath of political behavior, purely political behavior, that would become a federal crime under this theory. The petitioner also points out a history of prosecutorial expansion of the federal fraud offenses to reach increasingly broad categories of conduct involving state officials, private actors, and other parties seemingly attenuated from the federal prosecutorial interest. And this is true. There has been a very long history, starting in the 70s and sort of coming up through the present day, of the wire fraud and mail fraud statutes being used creatively to put into check a lot of state official and private behavior. Now, recently, the Supreme Court itself put a check on that expansion by federal prosecutors. And this was in a case involving former Enron CEO Jeff Skilling, who was charged with wire fraud on a so-called honest services theory for his role in the shady accounting strategies that brought down the energy giant. The honest services theory of wire fraud, which initially sort of was a creature of prosecutorial imagination, eventually itself struck down by the Supreme Court, but then reconstituted by statute. So the prosecutorial creativity that led to the honest services theory of wire fraud eventually did become the formal law of the land by statute. But essentially what honest services fraud does is to allow the government to charge a party for deception that deprives an employer, either public or private, of the honest services of its fiduciary. So in the Skilling case, for example, the government's theory was that by concealing from shareholders the large executive bonus he had coming that was tied to Enron's earnings per share, he was defrauding investors of his honest services. So the court pumped the brakes on this expansive reading of an honest services theory of fraud. And the court basically said that from moving forward, if the prosecutor is going to charge under this honest services theory, they have to prove that the defendant had concealed actual bribes or kickbacks from his or her employers. In other words, simply mere self-dealing, as the court put it, would not be sufficient. So the petitioner brings this case up because it does suggest that the Supreme Court is going to try to impose some stricter limits on the definition of wire fraud for these statutes. And Skilling, it's worth noting, he was still on the hook for securities fraud for all of his actual fraudulent accounting, but that's a story for another day. So here the petitioner is basically saying that if we hold public officials accountable for concealed political motives, we're running afoul of that principle that Skilling stands for, which is that we're not going to let mail-in wire fraud become sort of an amorphous catch-all, allowing all sorts of shady dealing to turn into a federal fraud crime. So that's kind of the argument that they make on that first prong, the nature of the deceit. On the second prong, which is the deprivation, the requirement that the government show that the victim has been deprived of something of value, the two parties disagree there as well. So it's important to note this is not an honest services fraud case like Skilling, even though it sort of has that flavor of honest services fraud where we're talking about sort of shady, self-motivated dealings by government officials. But in this case, the government is not arguing that Kelly deprived the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey or the state of New Jersey of her honest services, but of actual property, of time that paid employees spent lining all these cones up and shutting these lanes down, and the money that all of this cost. So the Supreme Court has already recognized that intangible property can constitute a deprivation in a fraud case. So the classic case on this principle is U.S. v. Carpenter, in which the Wall Street Journal's right to exclusive control of information that one of its columnists had drummed up and was going to eventually include in a financial column, that loss of exclusive control of that information constituted a deprivation of property. So we know that for the government to win here, it doesn't have to put a specific dollar value on what the defendants deprived the state of. Merely something related to the value of its employees' work actually would qualify. The petitioner notes, however, another relevant authority dealing with a public entity, not just a private entity like in the Wall Street Journal case. So in Cleveland v. United States, the defendant had essentially lied on an application he was making to the state of Louisiana for a license to run video poker machines. And there the Supreme Court found that there was no deprivation because Louisiana's regulatory interest in a licensing scheme is not a property interest, but an exercise of sovereign power. So at first blush, that case looks really helpful to the petitioner. It seems to create a distinction between a private employer's property interest in its employees' exclusive value added and a sovereign jurisdiction's interest in wielding its regulatory discretion. However, the government in its brief here distinguishes Cleveland on the grounds that in that case, Louisiana was not trying to make money off of the licenses. In other words, it didn't care about the $50 it was receiving every time someone applied for a license. It was instead just trying to regulate. It was just trying to decide who to grant licenses to and who not to grant licenses to. And so therefore, it's distinguishable from the current case. Indeed, in a more recent case, Pasquantino v. United States, the Supreme Court held up a federal fraud conviction of a defendant who had evaded Canada's excise taxes on alcohol. And the theory there was that tax revenue that the government of Canada would have received had the taxes been paid is the property of the Canadian government. So federal criminal law scholars sometimes debate whether Pasquantino and Cleveland can be squared. It may seem a little strange to say that the state of Louisiana has no property interest in its regulatory scheme, and therefore the federal government shouldn't be using wire fraud to get involved in it. And yet wire fraud is appropriate as a means of enforcing Canadian tax laws. That has been something that's sort of troubling, something that you raise when you teach a white collar crime class to get your students to argue about. But interestingly, this Kelly case kind of puts pressure on that distinction between those two cases and may be an example of something that could fall under that Pasquantino rule and not the Cleveland rule. In other words, while the Cleveland case was dealing with just should a decision be made one way or the other, the Pasquantino case was an effort by the court to kind of put a dollar value on what the sovereign government was being deprived of. And it's a bit of an angels on the head of a pin question when we get down to this degree of splitting hairs. But the government has a pretty good argument, in my view, after Pasquantino, that because there is a something coming out of the New Jersey and Port Authority treasury here, they've paid money for people to move these cones and waste time and so forth. This costs New Jersey money in a way that the video poker licenses did not necessarily cost Louisiana, that might make this seem more like a deprivation of property than in Cleveland. So basically, it seems like we might have a deprivation. The question of whether there was, in fact, deceit seems to turn on whose version of facts you believe. Was this a politically motivated traffic study or not a traffic study at all? The significance of that, of course, may also involve the question of, was it material deceit? Did the actual existence of the traffic study cause the state employees to spend their time and money to move the cones? It seems like there's a pretty good formal case for the government here. However, the actual question that's the court is going to need to resolve, however neatly some of the elements of the fraud offense may seem to be met here, the main question the court is still going to have to ask is, to what extent do we want prosecutors policing the dishonesty of state politicians? And that truly has been an issue in federal criminal law dating back to the Watergate era. We've had federal prosecutors use this Hatch Act, which specifically punishes bribery by state officials. And even RICO has been a means for the federal government to police state corruption. So there are obvious pluses and minuses. The pluses are that having the federal government as sort of the last resort to get in there and clean up state corruption, that has some obvious benefits. Minuses, of course, there's a federalism issue. Do we want the federal government to be making decisions in prosecuting that are itself politically motivated? In today's day and age, it's somewhat easy to imagine a politically motivated federal prosecution of politically motivated state corruption. Where do we want this line to be drawn? So my view on this is that probably the elements of wire fraud are met by the facts of this case, but the bigger question here really is going to be, to what extent do we want the balance of power to allow this type of prosecution to go forward? So it will be interesting to see what the court does with this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.